Just finishing lunch, start with meditation. There'll be some broken necks in, not just the audience, the monastics. If I sit up and drone on again, there'll probably be people falling asleep as well. So just to open it up for questions and answers. Anybody have anything that came up during the... Yeah. Not this morning. Yeah, we came. We came by car.
I didn't mean today. Maybe you started a week ago or something.
Right, right. No, that there was one time when that was actually the time that I did try that. It was to come to a teaching event, and I was going to walk, but I didn't make it.
When you spoke this morning, you mentioned a word I'd not heard before, and it was describing a layperson that accompanied the monk on Tudong.
Oh, okay.
What is their function exactly? Are they a helpmate, a companion, a gopher?
Yeah, all of those things, yeah. Anagarika is the formal word for a postulant in training, and at Abhayagiri... there, like today, we don't have one along, but oftentimes, if you see us come down from Abhayagiri, there might be somebody dressed in white, and that's a lay person who is taking precepts and training under the eight renunciant precepts, and they're because they have fewer precepts, then they'll say, like, still be driving, still have use of money, and do things like cooking, so that they're equipped to help out in many different ways. And but it's also a period of testing the waters of monastic life and seeing, okay, is this something I would like to do? Is this something that seems to fit? And then it's an opportunity to be a part of the community and to help out in a variety of ways, and then also to practice. So that Scott here does a Anagarika for 1 year, and then has come and decided, well, that was good, but it was maybe explore another way. And he's here at Spirit Rock working. There's also another Sean who's working here at Spirit Rock, was Anagarika for a year at Abhayagiri also. So it's a great opportunity to sort of get a feel for monastic life, and then to see, and then if one wants to go forward, say like the novice at the end there was Tuesday. Tuesday was prior that he was all white.
Oh,
yeah. so that he decided to use Anagarika for a year and decided to go forward, and so that and at Abhayagiri then as Ajahn Chah also would train, and it would be novices for another year, and continue to sort of see, okay, is it fit? Does it feel comfortable? And then novices have fewer precepts, but are sort of a bit more integrated into the get a feel for the lifestyle, because in say like Thailand and Burma, the it's fairly common to just almost walk in off the street and take ordination. Ajahn Chah didn't do it that way. He felt that he wanted to focus on the training, and people used to complain, "Wow, why do we have to wait so long to ordain as monks?" And Ajahn Chah said, "Oh, people who ordain quickly, they disrobe quickly." So it's just this, just having that time to sort of see, yeah, do we really want to do it? We've just started a a hermitage up in the Portland, Oregon area, and say at a Bayagiri, you know, it's a bigger community. We have lay people there. We have Anagarikas. We have novices. We have monks. And in setting up this new hermitage, the senior monk who was going up there wanted to experiment again, sort of part of the kind of the Tudong tradition, of taking that ethos and say, it'd be really nice to just to see, can we live there as monks without all the support, and in the sense of no resident lay people, no anagarikas, no novices, and which means that the monks are, they're there, they walk into town or around wherever they are and go for alms and see if they get anything. And there's no way to store food, there's nobody to offer it to them, and then just see how it works. And as an experiment. And they went to a place, there's a group in Portland that has been affiliated with us for many years, and they've always wanted to establish a kind of a branch monastery. And so it's finally come to fruition. But then when we found an actual physical place for them, for the monks to stay, then the predominant factor for decision making was, where's the cheapest rent? Something just what's going to come up that the group can afford, so that they ended up in the sort of Hood River Gorge area. So that they went there, they knew nobody in the community, and they just started going alms round, which impressed the local community very quickly, because where the hermitage is, probably a few miles away from, maybe probably 4 miles away from the town, but the elevation difference is over 2,200 feet. So they walk down and they hike back up again. And so it's a, but the local community has been quite wonderful. There's a real interest, and it's working. And then people, of course, people go there and they go and offer a meal, and because oftentimes they go on different routes around, and you know, oftentimes they don't get anything for alms round, but then the different people have sort of set it. Sort of made a commitment to go on a particular day, and so it all works. So it's quite inspiring, actually. Yeah.
I was recently reviewing the Dhammapada and came to one passage that really caught my attention. And let me read that first. Two passages. Life is apparently easy for one who lacks shame and is as impudent as a crow, who is arrogant, aggressive, invasive, and corrupt. Life is not easy for those who have a sense of shame, who are modest, pure-minded, and detached, morally upright, and reflective. And this morning when you were talking about living on faith, mm-hmm. the other side of that, I was thinking about how you, basically, you're increasing the potential anxiety level. So I come into Buddhism thinking, oh, this will calm me, this will settle my life. And then I realize there's being open, being aware, being sensitive to the world keeps bringing me new challenges that previously were uninvited. And I was wondering if you wanted to talk on that at all.
Exactly. Yeah, you get more than what you bargain for, eh? But that's in the Dhammapada verse, it's pointing out from a worldly perspective, in the sense of, it's not easy when you adhere to virtues and high standards because it goes against the stream of one's own habits and the tendencies of the world. But the reality is, of course, that that's where our place of well-being and harmony actually does come from. It's just leaping up over the kind of the bar of our habits, so that, you know, as we practice and use those circumstances for reflection and for investigation, then we start to gain a sense of confidence. And really, that's what faith is, because sometimes the you know, the word that we, it's normally translated as faith, saddha, but it's, you know, it's not such a good translation, because the faith has so many connotations in from a Judeo-Christian background in English, and the quality of confidence, and it's like a kind of a serene certainty that arises, and that can only arise from experience. So that as we take these different circumstances in our life and we investigate and practice with them and, you know, overcome various hurdles, you start to gain the confidence that, right, that's how, say, when we live together as human beings and we establish a very clear quality of virtue and integrity, we live together in harmony and trust. And that's, you know, and sometimes it would be easier to take a shortcut and not have to bother with those precept stuff. But you realize, oh, wow, it's those sort of things that are the protection. And those are the things that remind us that, no, it's integrity that allows us to have a sense of, establish a sense of trust and connection with people that we live with and the society that we live with or with family. And then internally, the result is one of happiness and well-being. One of the things that the Buddha pointed to as just a direct result of, say, of a virtue is non-remorse. You just don't have to feel bad about it. But then he goes through causal connections of how non-remorse takes you to a place of well-being, to a place of joy, to tranquility, to happiness. Then a concentration. Like the concentration arises from the well-being that you've established in the heart. The mind isn't wavering because it's second-guessing itself or has remorse or is caught in confusion of things that are, you know, been cutting, yeah, kind of corners. So it directly leads to a stability of mind. So the same with, you know, many other obstacles that we encounter, where being in a situation where everything sort of all the cells in one's body is sort of saying, take it easy, have a rest, you know, be comfortable, and then just putting that extra effort in. At that time, you see, we get up over that hurdle, and then, you know, what arises is a kind of a brightness of mind that comes from an internal source of being able to apply ourselves to things. So it's a training of the mind that gives us the tools to experience a brightness, even when sometimes you could be tired or kind of fed up or bored with something, but then you realize, oh, I can put that extra bit of effort in. I've done it before. I can do it. And then you get over that hurdle, and then you realize, oh, the mind becomes bright after that. So it says in meditation, that's a real boon, where the mind is really able to become still and bright, not because we've got everything just how we want it, but because we've been willing to just stick with it. So those are the you know, these qualities that we have to go against the grain a bit, but we learn. We also have to learn how to apply wisdom, because if you're always fighting to see if you can constantly go against the grain, then or you're feeling guilty because you're not going against the grain enough, you won't be happy either. So there's a balance, there's the discernment that needs to be applied and saying, well, when's the appropriate time to be able to just relax when one's coming up against an obstacle? and when's the time to push. And you can only do that from experience. And that's the say the heart of the practice is being willing to investigate and really become skilled in that quality of discernment. Yeah.
Well, first of all, I want to just thank you so much for being here. It's been such an awesome day so far. And my question is whether that can sometimes, the other side might be that the mind becomes punitive or punishing toward, you know, like, or that the mm-hmm. practices can be used that way.
Yep, absolutely. We're having a human mind. It's amazing how perverse it can be sometimes. Which is, you sort of say, ah, you know, you don't need to, you know, beat yourself up over things. But we do it. You don't need to push all the time, you know, but we do it. And, feel, and then we're, you know, that sort of, and one of the, I think particularly as Westerners, Americans in particular, very strong kind of ethic of guilt and being, you know, feeling, being tortured by being, you know, guilty, being feeling guilty about this kind of quality of guilt. I remember one time traveling as a translator for a senior Thai monk who I was his attendant and translator, and there was a evening chanting, meditation, Dhamma talk, questions and answers after, and one of the questions was, how do you deal with guilt in practice? And so then I went to translate the question, and I burst out laughing because I didn't actually know the word for guilt in Thai. And then what I had to do was explain to the Thai monk what a Westerner does to make themselves feel guilty, which just in itself was a, you know, sort of an exercise of in absurdity, and then he listened. Was listening to me explain, and he's got this very concerned look on his face. Said, oh, just tell them not to do that. That's suffering. You know? So they're being able to act, you know, really sort of, oh, yeah, we actually I don't have to do that. And to be able to be clear, because we do, you know, there's different ways that we torture ourselves, and to be, and that's part of the practice again of just being able to see habits and conditioning, and as we see those tendencies more clearly, then we can be developing strategies for ameliorating or overcoming or just being clear enough to say, oh. Being able to really sort of see it clearly, even if it's, you know, still rattling along, just, oh, that's that tendency. That's that habit. Okay, just because you don't want to get in there and fight and struggle and with it, because it's, just that taking exception to it and trying to annihilate it feeds it in its own way. I can remember Ajahn Chah talking about dealing with old habits and unskillful tendencies of our of defilements and attachment, and he said, you know, he said it's all you need to do is create a cage of mindfulness around it, and he said that's all you need to do. And he said it's just like if you've got a tiger. All you need to do is put a strong cage around it, and you know the tiger is going to be upset. It's going to be angry. It's going to roar. It's going to growl. It's going to beat at the bars of the cage, and all you have to do is make sure you don't open the door, and don't go in there. That's all you need to do. And he said, and you know, and that tiger it'll roar and it'll growl, but then I get tired and it'll lie down. and I'll get tired and sort of come up again. And it'll roar and growl, but it'll start getting softer. He said, you know, over time, if you just keep keep the cage closed and keep an eye on it. He said, you know, pretty soon it'll just every once in a while, meow, meow. Yes. So just having that cage of mindfulness is our. Again, we don't have to. We don't have to ride in on our white horse and sort of duel with it. We just, oh, that's what that is. All right, okay, I have to be cautious. Because you have to be careful as well. Yes?
So, you said that we should put a cage around tiger.
Yeah.
So we'll bring the tiger down and if we want to open it, it has no danger for us. Okay. But what about the situation that we just let it go?
Mm-hmm.
Why we should have a tiger in us? My confusion is over there.
Uh-huh.
Should we bring the tiger down and just still keep it inside, or should we just let it go?
Well, I mean, letting it go. Have you ever seen a tiger? I'd be careful. So that when you recognize it, greed or aversion, confusion, it has real consequences, and we have to be careful. We have to find strategies where, that we're not being bitten by it, because it tends to be indiscriminate. That sense of there's a healthy recognition of we're not fooling around here, that our own unskillful habits they have consequences. So one has to be very skillful and if there is a channeling of that, then it has to be really understood. It has to be well understood and well considered. Okay. Yes.
Sorry to keep staying with the tiger theme, but what about the case where one feels like one is the tiger and is trapped in a metaphorical cage? What would be your advice to escape that cage?
Right. Yeah. Well, again, just continuing with the metaphor, that sense of, because sometimes, and probably beginning with the original question of how we, because a lot of it is how we perceive ourselves, and the suffering that we create with those perceptions, the mind, our own mind can be our own worst enemy, and that we see ourselves in ways that can be negative and can be create a lot of discomfort for ourselves. So that to be able to, in terms of just sort of seeing and perceiving ourselves as a friend. Would we say or think things about ourselves that we would think about a good friend, so that we can learn to be good friends to ourselves, because there's so often somebody could say or do something and you realize it's that person, that's kind of how they're like, and if we did something similar to that, we'd beat ourselves up over it, to be able to, to switch that perception and be a good friend to yourself and look on oneself as a friend. Yes.
Staying with the theme of the cage and the tiger for a minute.
That's always got people's attention.
Certainly did. So, if sati or mindfulness is the cage, I'm wondering what the appropriate use of shamatha is. Because there are times I find in my practice where there's so much concentration that the defilements don't appear. mm-hmm. or they're very, very subtle. So I'm mm-hmm. trying to back off. Mm-hmm. Then it's a little bit uneven at the moment. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So. Well, I think, again, sort of the, you know, where the mindfulness is watching the tiger in the cage. And yeah, and the tiger does get tired. And then he gets up and he's refreshed. So that the but being able to using the mindfulness as the kind of the sphere of kind of protection, and then the samatha, the tranquility, is allowing things to settle, but then there's that ongoing investigation over time of what the effect is, because you know, the tranquility through meditation is oftentimes a covering over of the smoothing over of the defilements or the habits, and then you know they manifest quite happy actually, but refreshed, yeah. And that's the function of the investigation. You always want to be applying discernment and investigation, so that one's looking in terms of conditioning, habits, tendencies, not just personal habits, but the habits of what? The habit of delusion, the habit of attachment, the habit of aversion. And it's not a personal thing, which we tend to, of course, take it very personally. And but to sort of say, oh yeah, that's what the mind of irritation does. That's its habit. So that learning it more clearly, investigating it, and then using that clarity of discernment to be able to see, well, what's a skillful means of relinquishment? What's a skillful means of penetration, seeing, oh, that's its result, and then seeing just seeing the drawback really clearly, or the drawback of that particular tendency of the mind of defilement. That's its drawback. That's its painful consequence. And the more clearly one sees that, the more one inclines to relinquishment, and one needs the tranquility to see that. But then again, there needs to be the balance of the tranquility and the willingness to investigate. Okay, yeah. John.
When I found out you were speaking, I asked Nai what Tudong meant, and she explained it. Nai is my wife, and I said, "Oh, maybe he'll talk about the story of the tiger."
Because
I know you have a personal experience, I believe, shared with another group, and I was wondering if you could mind touching on that and how you dealt with that situation.
Oh, okay, sure. Actually, this past summer here at Spirit Rock, I shared that story with the teens, and they really liked it. They ended up the last night of the family retreat, the teens did this sort of skit with the me and the tiger. It was fun. I was cracking up. But one time I was on Tudong, just as I had completed my time of living independent on the teacher, and I was living on my own, and I wandered as a Tudong monk, and for many, many months, until it got to be rainy season, and when I entered the rains, it was in a along the border of Burma, in a remote wilderness area, really very pristine, and it was a small tin mine. So then I was. They built a little dwelling place for me out in the far enough away from the village to for it to be very quiet, and wandering for alms. So I was living out there on my own, And I had just a hut, a very nice walking meditation path that I was using regularly, and some nice stream flowing beside me, and kind of this lovely jungle, tropical rainforest jungle. And but then one night I'm doing my walking meditation, it's dark, and it rose up into quite steep hills on either side of the stream, and very thick vegetation. And I heard a noise that and got a sort of there's a noise and a smell about the same time, and before my kind of rational mind could sort of figure out what was happening, my whole body had already got just fear all the way through it. And the tiger has a distinct smell, distinct odor, very kind of musky smell. And then I could hear, so it's a tiger. And it was walking just above and around where I was meditating. And then it sort of tracked around, and it was just sort of there.
How far away from you?
15 feet, 20 feet, hard to tell. Yeah, 20 feet, you know, something, you know, not far. not far enough. And so I was doing my walking meditation, and then my hut was, it was pretty flimsy, so that, you know, you flash into my mind, oh, I better get to my hut. I said, well, what good is that? what came to mind was, and it was quite lovely, was this memory of one of the discourses of the Buddha in the Majjhima Nikaya, where the Buddha talks about when before he was enlightened, where he used to go to places of forest areas, wilderness areas, and then he would experience, he'd hear a sound, or there would be an animal, and it would provoke fear. And then the Buddha said, you know, what he would do would to just stay in that posture, and to continue in that posture until the fear had gone. So then I said, okay, well, I'll just have to do that. Because, and in it, you know, you're sort of sticking with that and just staying, just doing, walking back and forth and just really trying to calm the mind, because it's, there's something primal about the kind of fear of a predator like a tiger. And I'd been out in that area long enough to know what tigers could do. So I went through the options pretty quickly of what I could do if a tiger actually attacked. And it, very quickly, well, you just die. That's it. I mean, they'll actually attack elephants. They can do it. And they're extraordinary predators. They're really, yeah, top of the food chain, and humans in that situation are not very far along the chain. So that, but that that's what I use. And so that fear coming up very, very strongly, and just really walking back and forth until the, you know, just really calming the body and the mind, and then going and. After walking for, I'm not sure for how long, an hour, 2 hours, hard to say how long. Then I went and sat meditation. And as soon as I sat meditation, just the fear comes up again. And
the tiger's still there?
Well, it's hard to say. I could hear it and smell it for a while, but then it went off. I didn't hear it go, but I couldn't smell it, I couldn't hear it. So I assumed it had gone. But that isn't what my sort of rationally it had gone. Emotionally, it was definitely present. So that going and then sitting, and then, okay, remembering that discourse of the Buddha's, and just sort of, okay, sitting until it calming that fear, and letting that letting it come up, and just working with it, and letting it wash through. And that was really fruitful, because that you realize what a hold fear has on the mind, and but as strong as it can be, it's also impermanent, and it's easy to forget when it's right in your face. But just by being willing to just continue walking, continue sitting, continue investigating, establishing mindfulness, then you start to realize, oh, okay, that too is impermanent. And it's such it's almost trite to sort of say that, oh, it's just impermanent. But the reality is, when we see that uncertainty, that impermanent nature, the changing nature of the feelings, moods, impressions, thoughts in the mind, we come to a place of refuge, and that's the mindfulness and the clarity that can be established when it's seen for what it is. Yeah.
Is there a distinction between the awareness and the naming in terms of when you're naming something, does it bring some intellect or self into play, that a kind of just being aware of it without naming it is a different part of consciousness? That would be one question. Mm-hmm. And the other may be related, and that is, speaking of confusion, it's easy to know what wanting something or not wanting something is in a psychological way. But to know what confusion is this the sense of just nagging sense of self or self-consciousness?
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll try to address that. The that naming of things is you have to experiment with it, because sometimes it can work both ways, in the sense of by naming it, it actually clarifies it. Because sometimes our feelings can be, emotions or thoughts can be a bit sort of nebulous, and then they proliferate. So then there's not a clear edge, and then it just rolls on. So that by actually naming it, oh, that's restlessness. Oh, that, okay, restless mind, okay, wanting mind. It gives it a bit more boundary and clarity. So then when you name it, then it's a sort of, then it gives a place of, oh, okay, I can let that go. I can relinquish. I see it a bit. It helps you to see it a bit more clearly. So that's when, if you use it, that's a skillful result. It can go the other way, where one can get obsessed with trying to name everything and trying to have a name, have a handle for everything. And we can complicate the mind and make it, too sort of formal, we're a bit too obsessed with trying to get it right. So we're trying to, if we get the right name, then we'll be okay, sort of thing, which isn't how it works at all. So those are, it can cut both ways. And so you have to be attentive to what the result is.
Of naming is that you can let it go.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. That's the function.
That's the function. So that the hopeful result, is being able to let it go, to be able to relinquish, or to be able to be at ease with it, have a sense of equanimity. So that's, you know, whatever gets you there, that's fine. And then around the confusion, one of the things that I've always found helpful in dealing with confusion, doubt, kind of uncertainty in the mind, is rather than trying to go to the mind and figure it out or relinquish it there, or to come to the body, because you can get a sense of a continuity of clarity with just the sensations of the body, the posture of the body, the feeling within the body, whether the body is relaxed or whether it's tight or whether it's kind of agitated or however it feels. But you can get a bit more clarity with the body, and then develop a continuity of awareness. Because it's the momentum of awareness and attention that helps to break up the cloud of confusion. And so that coming back to the body, I've always found very helpful to get that continuity of awareness going.
So confusion is, you mentioned the word doubt.
Yeah.
But can you say what exactly is this confusion? What does that word indicate? You have the three things. What does that one mean?
Confusion, doubt.
Aversion and confusion. And then I'm not sure what's referred to about confusion, but you're about to say, right?
I'll get a name for it, you mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
One of the aspects of confusion is just sort of the lack of clarity, uncertainty, and not knowing. And that's the function of, from the Buddhist perspective, that's the function of moha, or delusion. And the three roots of defilement, greed, hatred, delusion. The delusion is moha, which clouds things. And when things are clouded, then there's, you know, either doubt, uncertainty, confusion, restlessness. So it manifests in different ways, but its root is this delusion, not knowing something's true nature, not seeing it clearly. And when it's not seen clearly, then it'll move the mind in either agitation, confusion, uncertainty.
I kind of perked up when you mentioned the words doing it right or whatever. I notice I have a little internal voice that seems to be judging whether I'm, it's like concerned as to whether I'm doing it right, you know, because if I'm not doing it right, I'm not going to get where I want to go or something, you know.
Yeah.
Would that be delusion that you're speaking of? Or?
Well, particularly if you're creating suffering around it. Yeah, which is usually what happens. Well, that sort of excessive concern for doing it right, the fear of doing it wrong.
Doesn't feel like I'm creating it. It just feels like it's running. You know what I mean? It's just kind of...
Well, that's again sort of where you see habitual tendencies, and that's exactly why we say we slow down and pay attention to something as uncomplicated as our breath. So then you start to be able to see the patterns that the mind takes as its default option. So it's learning. It's an opportunity for learning. Okay. There's a couple more questions back there.
Thank you. Well, I recently was trying to engage in practice that I think I didn't do right at all. So sorry, I'm a beginner, everybody. But so last year, there was someone in my life who did something that I thought was horrible, and I was very angry.
Mm-hmm.
So for Lent, being a Catholic, decided to practice metta every day for 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. And so prayed for her every day and was, you know, imagining her and thinking compassionate thoughts. And by the end of Lent, which is Easter, I was even more angry. Right. So I obviously didn't get it right. So I was wondering if you could speak to that.
Well, I guess that's when the Buddha gives us our sort of guidelines for, you know, how does it accord, does it accord with Dhamma or does it not accord with Dhamma? What the ways of deciding that is, does it increase suffering or decrease suffering? Or sort of, okay, if it's not working, sort of suffering is increasing, happiness is decreasing. If it's peacefulness decreases, then okay, this isn't quite working. But if peacefulness, tranquility is increasing, okay, that's, yeah, you see that, yeah, that's according with Dhamma. Because it's the nature of the Buddha's teachings to incline us in that direction. Is it a causal factor for wholesome mental states to increase or to decrease? So the sense of the content of the mind, is there more greed, hatred, and delusion, or is there less? So that those are kind of, you know, rules of thumb that one can be investigating, and then sort of saying, okay, now if it's not working, now what do I do? I've done it by the books. that's metta is high on the list of what the Buddha says we're supposed to do. So then you start investing, okay, how am I holding it? What expectation do I have? And so that we start investigating that sense of, oh yeah, I'm hoping that if I, you know, just sort of throw the metta bomb, that it'll all go away. Actually, there's more behind it than that, and I have to see that more clearly. And then looking at expectation, what was I expecting? What was I assuming? So then see, reflecting on that more clearly, because even if something can be, it's hard to imagine how directing loving kindness could be wrong in any situation. But then it's sort of, you know, as in, it's how we hold it, and then how deeply offended we are, I'm not really willing to relinquish that yet. I'm not really ready to let it go. So then being able to come back and look at that more clearly, why am I not ready to relinquish that? What is, and of course it comes back to that sense of self, the sense of me, and what am I holding? What was so deeply offended? And being able to investigate that. And then sometimes it's just by holding it, throwing it up in the air as a, all the possibilities are there. And then sometimes you sort of say, oh, well, there some new perspective comes up, or an idea of, oh, I could deal with it like this. And so that one gets a kind of a bit of an insight of, oh, okay, I can come around it this way. There's a teacher, another one of Ajahn Chah's teachers, and he had a very simple kind of way of encouragement in practice. He said, if the kilesas, the defilements come at you high, then you duck, and if they come at you low, then you jump over them. You know, so it's like, okay, you just got to find a way around them.
Somebody back there. Thank you. I'm curious about your pre-monastic life and specifically what led you to the monastic life.
Mm-hmm. I grew up in Canada, northern Canada. I grew up in the province of Manitoba, and it's about 600 miles north of the American border. There wasn't much Buddhism happening. And I was really looking for something. And when I went to university, then I came across books on Buddhism. And that really stimulated, that really caught me. The hook was in then. But I didn't have any way of practicing. There was no meditation groups. I never ever heard of anybody teaching meditation, teaching Buddhism. So that after I finished my bachelor's degree, then I decided to travel. And my idea was to go to Japan. I traveled all through Europe and Middle East, India, before I got to Thailand. I didn't even know Thailand was a Buddhist country. And so that I got there and said, wow, there's Buddhism everywhere. So I found a place where I could learn meditation and stayed in a couple different meditation centers. And then the last place I was at, there were some monks who said, well, why don't you ordain? And sort of, I couldn't do that. The idea, because in my mind it was like you'd have to make a commitment for the rest of your life, and I certainly wasn't ready to do that. Places to go, things to do, and they said, no, it's in Thailand it's ordinary to take a temporary ordination, so that I said, oh, yeah, 3-4 months, I could do that. So that was sort of the extent of my aspiration was to sort of learn a bit more about Buddhism, be a monk for 3 or 4 months, and then continue traveling. But yeah, the hook was in, so here I am 37 years later. And then it was shortly after I ordained that I kept hearing about Ajahn Chah and forest monasteries, because where I ordained was on the outskirts of Bangkok. And so that was just really appealing to me. And my preceptor encouraged me to go and pay respects to Ajahn Chah. So I was still fairly newly ordained, and I went up to the northeast of Thailand where Ajahn Chah lived and went to his monastery. And paid respects to him, and I was really taken by the lifestyle, the kind of the training that went on there. The monks, the nuns, the lay people—it was just seemed such a level of integrity. So I was really taken by that, but I also didn't stay. It was the first. It was actually arrived, and I went into the monastery, found out where Ajahn Chah was. I went and paid my respects, did my 3 bows, sort of finished my 3 bows, came up, and Ajahn Chah just sort of looked at me and said, "If you want to stay here, you have to stay at least 5 years." So that. that really I can't do that. But after being there for some weeks, then I went off and went somewhere else and continued practicing. But all during that time, I just kept thinking of Ajahn Chah. Something was really compelling. And so after sort of going back and forth in my mind and then extending my stay, and there's 5 years is 5 years. Go give yourself to Ajahn Chah. So that's what I did. And then, of course, I haven't gone anywhere since. Really. Yeah.
When you were telling the story about Cloverdale, I realized that if I saw you and the monks walking down the street of Fairfax, I'm not sure if I would know what to do. Mm. Is there a certain etiquette? I mean, how would I know that you weren't just meditating? How mm-hmm. should I approach you?
One is seeing if we've got a... One, you can approach a monk anytime. they are approachable. And if it were... One is that if it's in the morning time, before noon, and if they're carrying an alms bowl, which I think they've taken them out and put them back in the van, but the bowls that we received our food in and ate out of, if you saw a monk carrying a bowl, and you say, he's looking for something, then you could ask him to, could I make an offering? If you had any food with you, you could put anything in the bowl. Or if you said, could you just wait? And I could go and get something at the little shop somewhere and put it in. They'll definitely wait. But no money, yes. Yeah, correct. Yeah, yeah. And that's for a monk, we're not allowed to accept money or to use money. So. It makes our life simple. But again, it's sort of one of those things where, it's not convenient. But it's the inconvenience that allows you to investigate sort of expectation, desire, fear. Oh my God, am I going to get anything today? And that kind of anxiety is easily creeps in when your stomach's growling. Yeah. Yeah.
To what extent is spreading the teachings part of the Tudong tradition?
Yeah, actually, that's a good question. Spreading the teachings is a part of Tudong. It's an integral part, but it depends on the temperament or personality of the person, and but certainly it's an occasion because. You're out there, then it's occasion when you're accessible, and people can ask questions, people can approach you, and they do, and they'll ask questions, even if you don't feel you can expound the Dharma sort of thing. But just being an example is already an expression of the teachings. Ajahn Chah used to give an example. There's in the discourses, Venerable Sariputta, before he met the Buddha and became the chief disciple of the Buddha, his inroad was in seeing it was actually one of the first disciples of the Buddha, seeing him walking alms round in a town, in a village, and just that sense of composure and seeing the somebody who was a religious seeker, a peaceful person, just stimulated that desire in Sariputta and wanted to seek him out and asked for. Guidance. What is the teaching that you follow, and that was how Sariputta ended up becoming a disciple of the Buddha. So it's just seeing a good example, so that the in Thailand oftentimes part of the when they're walking for. People will gravitate towards sort of wandering Tudong monks to receive teachings because they think that that's somebody who's practicing and who's meditating. The opposite happens as well, in the sense of when I very first. Left the monastery to go Tudong, I just sort of walked out of the monastery and took a right turn and just started walking. And then got to the, going toward the end of the day, look for a nearby village, a little forest nearby, find a place to put up my mosquito net and get settled, and not very long, lay people start showing up, and what they want is lottery numbers. He's a meditator. He's a Tudong monk. He must know lottery numbers. So I was just being pestered till 11 o'clock at night for lottery numbers. So, I mean, that happens as well. So it,
Why did they think that?
No, it's just a belief. Okay, somebody, you had a question? Yeah.
Thank you for being here first. My question is about time. Mm-hmm. You spoke earlier about there never being enough time, and I was just traveling in Thailand and India for about 6 weeks, and I found that time really shifted for me.
Yeah.
And then coming back and having been home about 2 months now, with a daily meditation practice, time speeds up.
Yeah.
And so I'm just curious how life is at the monastery versus the Tudong, and what you have to say to lay people about that speeding up of time.
Yeah. I mean, it's not, as human beings, it pushes us, and even if you're on Tudong, you can still sort of, you can still do it to yourself. And in the monastery, you can do it. We can do the same thing, but you know, there are these kind of conscious reminders, and so just really trying to bring that to mind as a lay practitioner. I think it's really important to set certain times aside that are really kind of sacrosanct, and doable, because I think if you set the bar too high, then you end up sort of frustrating yourself or giving up. But just really setting time aside where you really give yourself that time and open. Say you don't even have to necessarily be meditating formally, but just sitting and taking time to not be doing anything. Also, just paying attention to the compulsions of, say, like when you come back into, coming home, coming to your home or your apartment or whatever, and recognize, what's the habit? What's the first thing you do when you get there? And, you know, and oftentimes it's, go to the fridge, turn on the computer, and then to really consciously go against that and just sort of say, no, when I come home, I'm going to do this. Set something up that starts to break the routine of because, one gets home, oh, I need to do this or I should do that. And just putting those little blocks, and they don't have to be extreme, but they're reminders of where it does give you an opportunity to slow down a bit and not be pulled into that habit pattern. And so those are just a couple simple things to pay attention to. I mean, it's helpful to have a space that you go to where you like having a shrine. It is really helpful. And you don't have to be really a devotional type to have a shrine, but it's sort of like this is a physical reminder of, and that's where you see setting something up. That's where you meditate. That's where you stop. That's where you slow down, and that's a space where you come into, and you do that on on a daily basis, and that, because you, again, habits and conditioning, it's not just bad habits and conditioning that we have. We can be doing really good ones. We can be really developing really skillful habits that really put us in good stead. Okay. Yes.
I just wanted to say really wonderful.
Thank you. All the thoughts that I've had have been, my questions have been answered or asked by someone else. So, but you have a wonderful sense and a gift of giving and consciousness. I feel. To those of us around that are here and enjoying the experience. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I was going to ask, how did you come about this? And I was going to ask, you know, all of these two questions that have happened in the last few minutes. So I will just consciously say thank you so much, all of you, for coming and spending some time with us and opening us up to what is going on in the Tudanrat. Respect, and also if one wanted to come and visit the monastery, is that possible? What is the proper way? And you know,
okay. Monasteries in Thai Theravada tradition are open places. People can come at any time, and so that the monastery is available for free people to come and to tap in, to join in. There's the formal meal offering at around 11 o'clock in the morning. We have tea time and later in the afternoon. Every Saturday night there's a Dhamma talk. Every lunar quarter there's a meditation, chanting, Dhamma talk, vigil in the night, so people can tap in at any time of that. If anybody wants to come and stay, and to stay in the monastery for a shorter or longer visit, then to contact ahead of time is helpful, and just email's probably the easiest. guestmonk@abhayagiri.org, and then set up a time that works. So we've got accommodations for men and women, and it's not say like a retreat per se, but it's an opportunity for people to participate in the lifestyle, so that just joining in the daily routine. Morning chanting, 5 in the morning meditation, helping with the chores, sharing the meals that we have, having time in the afternoon for personal time, joining in the group routine of the evening sittings, so morning, evening sittings. So that's something that is available to people. Okay, I think we should be doing some meditation. We've been sitting here for almost an hour and a half, so might be good to have a period of walking meditation. And again, to take the opportunity to find a quiet space that's nice and flat, 10 paces, 20 paces, it depends on if you walk slower, and it doesn't have to be so long. If you walk a bit faster, a bit longer is good. At the monastery, every dwelling place in the at Abhayagiri, and most forest monasteries, will have a walking meditation path at the dwelling place. And so it's a sort of a natural rhythm of life. And so walking meditation, sitting meditation, so taking that opportunity to walking, paying attention to the, again, connecting with the body, the physical rhythm of the walking, and lifting the foot, moving it, setting it down, connecting with that contact, this touch. It's a concrete anchor for awareness and attention. It's that sense of touch as we're touching the ground. It's also helpful. I always found walking meditation really helpful because by paying attention to the sensation of the feet touching the ground, I'm about as far away from my head as possible. That's just a real relief. It's getting it in and developing that continuity of awareness and attention. You know, inevitably, there's thoughts come up in the mind, and just to recognize and note them again. You don't need to get in there and fight with them. You don't get in the cage with the tiger, but you say, "That's okay. There's another thought. There's that pattern of thinking and going again. Okay, back to the feet. Just noting it, recognizing it, but not getting caught, not getting hooked. Okay, so we can have a half hour period of walking.